All right, well, welcome. And this evening's talk is one in a series that is on living a balanced life and is based on a series of suttas that are more about social conduct and engagement in daily life and aimed at householders than they are aimed at monks and nuns. So, in the context of this particular talk and the suttas that I'm going to be referring to, which many people don't realize that the Buddha gave talks on wealth and money management, for example, management of your resources. Okay, so I told this story just when we had gotten back from Asia, but I'm going to tell it again because I think the story has some significance other than just saying what it means. It's helpful. And so when we were on this pilgrimage in Asia, we were traveling by bus, a chartered bus, a lot of the time in India. And we had this bus driver, an Indian man named Shyam. And I thought he was just a bus driver. And we started off on this trip. And yeah, I'd done this before. And in India, when you travel by bus, there's the bus driver, and then there's always a second, usually younger man, who's kind of a facilitator. So there's the driver, and then the person who's facilitating a lot of different things. And so I was familiar with this model, and I was familiar with what the traditional role of the bus driver was supposed to be. So one of the first places we got to, got off the bus, went in, and the routine is wherever we would get to, whether it's a small, modest little hotel that's embedded right near one of the Buddhist sites, or whether it was in the monasteries we'd stay in, get off the bus, go in, two of us, and we would check in with the management and just work through basic things, register everybody, and then particularly talk about food and the menus for everyone. And there were certain people who had dietary issues. And so we went into this one location, and the people we were working with, their language, their English, their broken English wasn't all that good, and our Hindi was non-existent. So we were kind of having trouble working through this, all the different items, and they were really trying to accommodate us. So it's like, well, what do you want for breakfast? You know, what do you want for lunch? What do you want for dinner? And they give us a list like this. You know, it's an arm's length long. I couldn't believe it. And much of it on there, I didn't know what it was. So we're kind of trying to negotiate this, and all of a sudden, the bus driver, Shyam, is like, just like right over my shoulder, and he's saying, oh, you know, this is that. You know, he'd describe it, and, oh, this is very good, and it's made that way. And so it was like unbelievable, like the resource he was. So without him, with him, we ended up with these really nice meals. Without him, we probably would have been eating old shoes with spaghetti sauce on them or something, based on my communication level. So then at that same trip, we were in an area where there was like a public market, and down towards the end of this public market, you're starting to go into a section of town that we wouldn't probably want people to go unattended, and particularly women in the group. And so people came back and said, well, you know, we were down at the far end of this public market, and all of a sudden Shyam was there. And it was like he was kind of like intervening and helping us negotiate with one of the vendors. And it was really clear to me, after listening to the story, that he really wasn't there to help them negotiate with the vendor. You know, that like he was actually shadowing them and watching out for them, and then, you know, kind of intervening to, in a way that was unobtrusive, where he wasn't saying, hey, you know, you shouldn't be down here, and he just kind of like redirecting. So as the trip went on, this just became a regular thing. I mean, he was kind of shadowing everybody in the most unobtrusive, caring way. We would be eating, and in one place where Ine looked up, and he's coming out of the kitchen, and he's telling one of the servers to take the food back because it's not the way he thinks it should be. And so he just really became a part of the group, and just showed how much he cared about what he was doing, and actually cared about what we were doing, and cared about us. And one of the members of the group got sick, pretty sick, and you know, we were up giving him sponge baths to keep him cool and all these things. And so, like, it's 10 o'clock at night, which would normally be the time when Sean and the second man would have had their dinner and gone to bed. And there's a knock on the door, and he's got some fruit and he's got some juices that he thinks, you know, might help hydrate, you know. And then, so he's explaining this to him, and he puts them down and goes over and starts giving the sick member of our group a massage. Ends up giving him a full body massage. I mean, like, nobody asked him to do this, right? So, and I could go on for a long time. It was extraordinary. And what I realized, and I think some other people in our group realized, was that he was actually a saint or a bodhisattva or something in disguise. If you know the Bhagavad Gita, and there's the story of Arjuna, who's from a young ruling family, and the story of the Gita is this huge poem. It's part of a much longer work, and the scene takes place, much of it, on the edge of a battleground. And so Krishna, who is one of the Hindu gods, is disguised as the chariot driver, and is counseling Arjuna. And so that's how I kind of felt about Sean, that we didn't realize it, but he was some like really special guy. So in India, all the buses, the bus drivers will have like a little shrine on the dash. And so he had Krishna there, which I understood that. And then he had this great big panoramic window bus. It was fabulous, particularly if you were sitting up front. It was like you were almost on the road in the front of the bus. This thing was so big. And he had hanging from the ceiling like a chain, and then this human figure that's kind of like in a prone position, like he's flying. And he's holding something in his hands and what have you. So, and I didn't know what that was, you know. So after I got to know him, and we got to be pretty affectionate towards each other, the group was off someplace and just the two of us on the bus. And I said, Chum, what is that? You know, what is that? And he says, that's Hanuman. And I knew Hanuman because one of my first person-to-person teachers, and probably my most important first teacher, was a Hindu man, and the god that he had taken on as his model was Hanuman, and Hanuman is this symbolic god of service. So I said, oh, okay. So I said to him, okay, so I know what Hanuman is, but why do you have Hanuman there? And it was the only time during this entire, you know, many, many, many hours over, you know, a number of weeks being together, that he kind of looked at me like I just didn't get it. You know, it was like, wow, that question verges on being stupid, you know. And so he said, well, I have Hanuman there to protect me so I can protect you. so beautiful. So the significance of that story for me is what a direct line there was for this man between his spiritual life and how he was embodying his spiritual life in daily life. That there was no separation, and that the line was direct. You know, it wasn't intellectual. It didn't have to be, you know, some theory that had to be converted into something, or, you know, like, well, what does that mean? How could I implement that in my life? I mean, it was direct and organic. And my belief is, what I've come to believe about the teachings of the Buddha is that if you are just willing to really reflect on the teachings, that there is always a direct line. That none of these teachings are just philosophy. None of them are just theory. And it's just a question of our understanding what that direct line is, and in that directness is where the power of the practice comes from. It's like a drive chain between, it's between the engine and the wheels. I mean, it's a direct line that can inform our life. So in this context, in the context of these particular things I'm going to talk about tonight, a balanced life means a balance between the attention and energy. You know, attention in Buddhist practice is everything, because attention drives our perception. And the Buddha said the core problem is that we were misperceiving things all the time. You know, that we would look at things that we and perceive them as pleasurable, and actually they were painful. And we're doing them because we're compensating for something, or that we're striving for something, or we're denying something, or we're in aversion to something. But we don't know that that's what we're doing, because the perception is that it's something else. And he called that delusion. So balance in this sense means the attention and then our effort, our energy that's driving both our attention, our perception, and our conduct. Where on the one hand it's being directed into living a responsible, caring daily life at this level, and on the other hand that there's a balance between that and the effort and attention that we're devoting to leading an informed spiritual life that is directed towards liberating the mind from suffering. And I emphasize that last piece about directed towards or aimed towards the liberation of the mind from suffering, because we're in a time period now which is very rich with respect, or potentially very rich with respect to the Dharma, and also I think it has very high potential to confuse people about at least what this particular practice is or can be. There is now mindfulness. It has become, so popular. It's now become a commercial commodity. For years the phrase has been, like having a Zen moment or something like this. And I'm sure pretty soon there's going to be a lot of having a mindful moment, And I think what's happening, if you look at the literature and even a lot of the many, many books that are coming out now who are not by Dharma teachers, but kind of look like they're by Dharma teachers or about the Dharma, is that we're uncoupling mindfulness from the purpose of mindfulness when it's embedded in the Dharma. And when embedded in the Dharma, the purpose of mindfulness is insight and liberating insight, which shows the mind how and why we're suffering and liberates the mind from that. And so much of what's being put out there now is uncoupling these two, okay? So I really want to stress that, because if we lose that element, we lose that direct line I'm talking about. I mean, it's a direct line to no place. You know, you may feel better, you may have some insight into your daily life, you may actually feel better. I mean, there may be all kinds of benefits to mindfulness divorced from dharmic insight, but one thing that it will not do is take you home. It will not liberate the mind. So I put here that the context for understanding these teachers is related to a simile that the Buddha used about a glamorous or beautiful peacock and a simple swift swan. And the Buddha used a lot of similes and teaching illustrations about animals and birds because of the nature of the time. He lived in an agrarian society, and also because they're memorable. So in this case, the simile is from a discourse or a talk or a teaching called the Discourse of the Sage. And in that discourse, he says the following: even as the crested blue-necked peacock that soars in the sky never will reach the speed of the swan, even so the householder, that's you and me, cannot hope to match the monk or nun, the sage, leading a life of seclusion, contemplating in the forest. So, even as the crested blue-necked peacock that soars in the sky never will reach the speed of the swan, even so the householder cannot hope to match the monk or nun, the sage, leading a life of seclusion, contemplating in the forest. Okay, so initially that kind of sounds kind of negative, right? And for any of us who wanted to be the speedy swan, it's particularly disappointing. But actually, there's something very important here that informs everything else. And what's important here is that the Buddha in this sutta is implicitly stressing that the goal of spiritual practice, whether it's in seclusion as a monk or nun, where your entire life is devoted to that, or in daily life, the end game is the same. The end game is to have an awakened mind. And so I think it's a common misconception that if you're a householder, the idea is well, you can't become awakened. You can't become liberated. And I don't believe that that's the message of the suttas at all. In fact, I think it's just the reverse. And certainly here in the West, the way that we're teaching the Dharma is that many of the suttas that, generally speaking, householders would not previously have heard, we're using is like the basic teachings to be working with. Which I think creates for a lot of people all kinds of confusion and striving and all kinds of things. But I think in the West we've decided we're willing to take on that risk because we're, I think, creating kind of a new approach to the Dharma. And even traditionally, now in Asia and for many, many years in certain countries, it is not uncommon for householders at one or more times in their lives to ordain and be in a monastery for a year or multiple years and come out, or every 5 years ordain for 6 months. And there's a lot of that. So householders are exposed to, even in other cultures, where they're not being exposed to some of the suttas that we're talking about, just as a matter of course, like here on Thursday nights, are exposed to them when they go in and ordain and then come back out again. Okay. And so the point here is that all of these teachings about daily life that there is no teaching that says, well, here's the teaching, go ahead and be mindless in doing it. They're all based on the premise that we're attempting to cultivate in the context of the action itself a kind of awareness that illuminates the quality of our mind, our relationship to our experience, and whether we're suffering or we're not suffering. Okay? This is like really important. And just as an aside, you know, with all of this, these illustrations about animals, similes and teaching images, the wheel of life or the wheel of samsara, we have one on your left here, and on this Tibetan tanka, it commonly has animals and birds. And I've always thought that the symbol for delusion, for misperception, should be the turkey. but you may not know why. See if you've heard this. So when my father came here from Canada, he had a large family, and he moved here by himself, and was uneducated, but incredibly industrious and self-educated, and eventually just in the particular industry he was in, the industry he was in, he rose up to the very top of the industry. You know, it's one of those kind of extraordinary stories. But when he first moved here, he was working for Union Oil. Does Union Oil even exist anymore? I don't. They do, okay. And so he had that, and then he had a he got enough money to get a little bit of land and a house, and then he started bringing all of his family, bringing them here to the U.S. And he had a turkey farm. And he would tell the story that in heavy rains, the turkeys would go out, and they would put their head up and open their mouths. And they would stay there, and many of them would drown. That's the truth. Okay. So I thought that this was like a perfect illustration of misperceiving what is pleasurable or necessary as being just the reverse. Right? You know, or a certain amount of it, and then it goes. So the my personal symbol of delusion is the turkey. And when I was growing up, I don't know, many of us are of this age, but when I was growing up, one of the common phrases that you heard, I'm sure that this, you don't hear it anymore, this would be considered unhip, but if somebody did something that was like particularly stupid or they made a bad decision, you'd say, oh, he or she's a turkey. Okay, so now I appreciate, it's only now that I appreciate the wisdom in the comment. Okay, so one way I think what I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes is several talks that the Buddha gave about money and wealth and a number of other things, and there's a whole series in this of different topics like this in this series of talks that he gave. But I think one way to think of all of these talks is to think of them in relationship to the metta phrases. So the metta phrases say, you know, may I or may you be safe and protected, and may you be peaceful and happy. Okay, so may you be healthy and strong. You be able to care for yourself and live with ease. You know, may you be free from suffering. And so if you think about the essence of those phrases, if you don't have some of these things in your life, it is very, very difficult to do other things in your life. So if you don't feel safe and protected, you know, it's really difficult. If you don't feel safe and protected in the relationship, it's really difficult to disclose yourself and to have intimacy, right? If you don't feel safe and in a protected sense in your employment. You know, you're afraid to take risks and work with other people. And so, you know, that, and that just applies to everything. So each one of these metaphrases, you know, for myself, I think inform the intention behind a lot of other teachings, because they're trying to establish a foundation, which then is the springboard or the foundation or the baseline, however you want to think of it, that allows us to practice in an open, appropriately risk-taking and courageous way. Because you, in my opinion, you have to have a lot of courage to do this practice. Once it starts revealing itself to you, it starts revealing stuff that we would prefer not to have revealed to us. You know, it's kind of humiliating. And the thing that makes it not humiliating is that we start realizing that it isn't the reflection of some defect in us. I mean, we deeply understand that we acquire these very deep habits of misperceiving in the world, of making bad decisions when we think we're making good decisions, and hurting ourselves and others, even when we think we're doing good. And so much of practice is that slowly being revealed to us. And the beauty about the practice is it reveals itself to us in, as a general rule, in a very safe way. You know, the practice doesn't reveal something to you that you're not ready to see. So, you know, we start to see these things, and they don't feel so personal, you know. So, okay, so on the little handout that I gave, the first thing that I identified there, and this is one of the Buddhist talks, is he identified four types of happiness of living a householder's life. And when I first saw this, I really found it interesting. And the first time I saw it a long time ago, and frankly, I looked at it and I was uninterested. Because it was like, no, I want to get to the really good stuff. I want to know about all these altered states of consciousness and getting free from all of this trouble in my life and everything. And so here's the Buddha in my interpretation of this is talking very much about what's in the Metta Sutta. Like not only how conducting ourselves in certain ways in daily life can bring us happiness, but they are the vehicle for bringing us happiness and for creating a kind of stability that allows us then to practice spiritually. So the first one is the well-intentioned ownership of property and wealth. And it's actually about the acquisition of wealth. And so what the Buddha is talking about here is not about getting wealthy, but about how we acquire wealth. Okay. So there's nothing in the suttas that is negative about acquiring ownership of land, of acquiring money. In fact, it's just the reverse. You know, the next one, which I'll talk about, is that there's all these benefits to acquiring wealth. But the first is, how do you acquire what you acquire? Whether it's an accumulation of wealth or whether you're living modestly. And so we know that in the Eightfold Path, there's right action, and part of right action is not engaging certain kinds of professions. And if you used the, I'm just trying to link together, I'm trying to work through, you know, how do all of these things fit together, you know, if we don't see that. And so the way I think of this is the precepts. So, you know, the first precept is about non-harming. So in terms of the acquisition of wealth or whatever we have, that we do it in a way that doesn't harm ourselves or other people. And if it does either of those things, you know, even if we're not hurting anybody else, we're just hurting ourselves. That from a Buddhist perspective, then it not only is right wrong action, it has negative karmic implications. That the implications of that are that we're training our mind and creating these habits that are actually harming us and will continue to harm us unless we see that that's become a habit of mind. So, second precept is only taking what's freely given. So I think, you know, the most obvious implication of that is persuading someone in some way to give up their money, to enter into an agreement with you, or to buy something from you, or to do something that they really don't want to do. But because of the kind of pressure that we put on them emotionally or psychologically, that we're able to acquire something. So this is in the context of acquiring property or wealth, but in relationships. I mean, once again, there's a direct line both ways. I mean, good and bad. I mean, all the opportunities we have to influence people that we know, particularly people who are really close to us, by leaning on them emotionally in a way that's inappropriate to get our own needs met. You know, so you know, I think it's pretty clear the Buddha would say that's really inappropriate, and it has negative karmic consequences. Third precept, basically about right speech, gossip, speech that harms other people. From a business standpoint, that you don't engage in speech that hurts your competitor so that it benefits you. So you're, you know, spreading rumors that undermines their credibility in the community or undermines people's beliefs about their products, which, of course, is pretty common in our society, you know. The fourth precept, sexual misconduct. You know, I'm an attorney by profession, and I do a lot of work with larger entities, and it's surprising to me how the use of sexual favors to acquire something is not all that uncommon, you know, in business. Finally, the fourth precept about the consumption of alcohol or intoxicants, and you know, once again, pretty obvious, but not using some kind of an intoxicant to influence or someone or put them in a position where they are vulnerable, and then you convince them to do something. So all these teachings interrelate, but this first one about the well-intentioned ownership of property and the acquisition of wealth has to do with how we acquire something. That it's fine to have wealth. And, you know, there's many, many stories where the Buddha advises wealthy people and that they are his patrons. So the second piece of the sutta is about the wise consumption of what you actually have. So the disappointing limitation on the first one about acquiring wealth for some people is that the Buddha said that wealth for wealth's purpose, you know, just as an objective in and of itself, was not appropriate. You know, so the acquisition of wealth as an objective just by itself would actually fall into the category of wrong action. And that what you were seeking, why you were, what's appropriate about seeking income and wealth is to have the intention to do particular things with it. So he said that that you would do it for the benefit of yourself, your family, your in-laws, which I understand is probably an issue with some people, with friends, and in support of your spiritual life and ethical conduct. So then that would encompass supporting your sangha and your teachers. So the purpose for acquiring the wealth is there a purposeful drug in the Buddha's mind? The third part of this is, and I find this fascinating, okay, that one of the happinesses of a householder life, and also one of the vehicles to feeling safe and secure so that you can practice, is being debtless. So they didn't have credit cards at the time of the Buddha, did they? They may have had open accounts, I don't know. But being debtless through responsible management of your resources. So, I mean, like, as a practice, you know, which was infused by the spiritual goal, that you would actually pay attention to your finances as a spiritual goal and a spiritual practice. You know, I mean, like, it's fantastic, right? Like, no separation between spiritual life and daily life. You know, a direct line between your purpose as a spiritual practitioner, the acquisition of wealth, the management of your assets. And then the final piece, and this is more familiar to most of us and what we hear more of, is being blameless through ethical conduct and relationship. And this, you know, the Buddha just stresses over and over again in so many different suttas that the value of ethical conduct and sound decision making is that you develop this sense of blamelessness. So, you know, repeatedly in the Metta Sutta and other places, he talks about not doing anything that the wise would disapprove. So, this idea of blamefulness and ethical conduct is just, you know, another word for restraint, right? Restraint and then wise decision making about action. But so much of it, particularly at the beginning, is just restraining yourself from doing certain things impulsively and making bad decisions. So as that starts to develop, it really is true, and, you know, I'm sure many people here would attest to this, that as your practice develops and the strength of this ability, this restraint, develops in your life, you really do. It gives you an enormous sense of self-confidence that you're not going to hurt other people and you're hurting yourself less and less. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and it's a direct line, it's a direct product of practicing the precepts mindfully and of ethical conduct. Okay, so linked with these four types of happiness for the householder are four requirements of the good life here and now. So these kind of link up. So the first one is the cultivation of energy, in one translation is to initiate new ventures or to facilitate these four goals up above. And so basically this has to do with looking at your life and taking care of yourself. You know, and this links with all the teachings, the fifth precept about overconsumption of anything that hinders your mindfulness. And so, yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. You know, like, you take care of yourself in such a way that you have a certain level of energy to devote your attention and your energy to these purposes. And that's a precondition to living a skillful life. The second one is, it pretty much relates to one of the ones above, but it's the protection of what is earned, you know, and but that's through the wise management of your resources. But once again, I mean, really highlighting the fact that you acquire something, and if it is actually supporting the stability of your life, supporting yourself, your family, your in-laws, your teachers, your sangha, then you really want to protect that. A third, keeping good friends. We hear this a lot, but particularly good spiritual friends, they're just no substitute, in my opinion, for, you know, having a good spiritual friend. I mean, You can talk with a good spiritual friend in a way that you can talk with no one else. And you can talk about principles of how the Dharma applies to your conduct, which is lost on other people. You know. And then fourth, living a balanced life, which is this idea of balancing the temporal world, you know, our attention and our energy relating to living a responsible and ethical and a sound daily life, and same with our relationships, and balancing that off with the attention and energy we're devoting to our spiritual life, and then allowing those to inform each other. And so when the Buddha talks about balancing them, he's actually talking about balance. So for me, it raises the question of, well, what kind of energy are we devoting to our spiritual life compared to the energy that we're devoting to everything else? And you notice that here, and I don't think there's any suttas that contradict this, what I'm about to say, but this is my assumption, an informed assumption, is that notice that on the list of the four types of happiness of living a householder's life, it doesn't include, you know, like having a wild social life. Now, you know, I think it's implicit in community and sangha and having good spiritual friends, obviously, you know, that you have a sound set of relationships and community that so you enjoy yourself and you're enriched in that way. But that aspect of it by itself isn't put up by the Buddha as a separate item to pursue. It's the product of these other things. So the end goal in this idea of a balanced life is that there is a complete integration between our daily life and our spiritual life, that we do see the direct line between the teachings and literally everything that we do. No exceptions to the rule. You know. So I think that takes reflection. I think it actually takes some hard work. I think it takes a lot of courage, because we bump up against a lot of realities that we want to turn away from. We see that there's a lot of work that we have to do that we would prefer not to do. And we need to do it if we want to get free. But the seamless integration is the end game of this practice. Because if the very starting place was that mindfulness separated from this embedded idea of insight, if you separate those, well, the end game is the liberation of the mind. We can't be turning away from anything. In the end, that becomes our desire. And it also becomes our inspiration. Because as we start to do that, as we turn towards what we're fearful of, that we don't think we have the courage to face, we don't think we have the energy to face, and we do it, and we move through it, then we begin to feel different about ourselves, we begin to feel different about our lives, and we become inspired. Because we see that the Dharma is our constant friend and will take us through that and will set us free. That's the extraordinary thing about this, is that at some point your own life becomes your inspiration. That the Dharma operating in your life becomes your inspiration. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, and then finally, you notice there's all these are the lists of fours tonight. The Buddha identified four qualities of mind that support lasting happiness and happiness of the householder. You know, the first one being trusting in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and remembering to turn off your phone. that's an obscure sutta. Most people don't know about that. Yeah, that's a commentary. There you go. So this list should all look familiar, but you can see that this list is a little configured a little bit differently than the list that we normally deal with. You know, so up front and first is the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is practice. Secondly is ethical conduct, then generosity, and then wisdom. You know, and I think the implication of that is that the first three lead to the fourth. You know, so those are my comments on this. And as I say this every time, the rare occasions when I finish with a fair amount of time left, it's always kind of shocking to me. I know it's probably shocking to you too, but we do have some time here to talk about this a little bit, or for comments, or and it can be questions on this, or if there's other questions that are kind of on your mind about practice that you're looking for an answer, we can do that too. So.
You put in the context of the end game liberation, enlightenment. That's always been a favorite word, enlightenment. And we struggle. There's a question coming. We struggle with too much striving. And for myself, I mean, I started meditating and practice to reduce my suffering. And I never have thought of, well, not never, but I have not often thought and striven for enlightenment. I think you might be saying something different tonight. So I'm like, and another thing that has always come to mind is this idea of, my level of practice and understanding, and at my age, I'm not going to become liberated, at least not in this lifetime, you know. And that brings up the question of, well, how much striving should I be doing for how many lifetimes? but it does create a little bit of a dilemma, it seems to me, for me anyway,
yeah.
In terms of practice, a regular practice.
Yeah. Okay, so I would word this: is it does create what seems like a tension or conflict? Yeah, and just as a starting place, you and I are about the same age, right? So I'm not giving up on the idea of awakening.
Wow.
So. Yeah, so I think there's actually a bunch of questions in there, okay? And the first one is you know, the context for that comment of mine was that the end game is insight, because insight leads to liberation, okay? So in any moment of sitting or activity, if your actual thought or your the energy that's driving that act in that moment is, I'm going to get awakened, okay, then we're off purpose, okay? When we're on purpose is, in this moment I'm trying to be as awake and mindful as I can and see into the way I'm engaging this, and whether it's leading to suffering or pointing my mind in a different direction, which leads to insight. So it's completely transactional. So if I can stay in that, you know, I have this immediate purpose of understanding, which is going to lead to insight, okay? Which is different than I'm striving to be awakened right now.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So, like, when I'm sitting here, when one of the mentors is sitting here and we're giving a talk, what we're trying to do is actually be awake and be mindful, and we're using this as a practice. So I can sit here and monitor, like, whether I was really listening to your question or preparing my answer.
Yeah.
Right? I can see that, okay? If what I'm doing is going, okay, I'm going to really do good on this, and that's going to, I'm going to get awakened by the way I answered Jerry's question. Well, you know, I'm off the reservation. Okay? The idea of, you know, what it takes to get awakened is an interesting question. At the time of the Buddha, you know, if you read some of the short biographies of the people that were around him, it seemed like everybody's getting awakened left and right. Everybody's, you know, okay? And so, you know, is that because of multiple lifetimes of work that came to fruition in that life? You know, if you're a person who believes in that model, the answer is probably yes. Okay? But I think the issue for me is, you know, like you're saying, well, I'm at my age, how could I? And I look at that and I'm talking about myself now, but I look at myself and I look at how defiled my mind is sometimes, and I just say, how could it not take multiple lifetimes? Yeah, I mean, that's my, you know, seriously. You know, and particularly when my mind collapses down, and I'm in my little ego mind, you know, it's like, oh, man, I mean, how? So, my thinking about this right now is on a couple of fronts. One thought is the issue isn't whether I'm going to get liberated in the classical sense that every negative state of mind is uprooted and what have you. Right now, I'm actually completely satisfied with the idea that I'm moving through my life and that I can actually see some progress, some very deep progress. I have so much compassion for the person who started this practice as a young man, you know, like, that you know, I look back on that, it's just like how much that person was suffering, and I see that I'm not even close to that person. You know, I still see that I'm all screwed up at a lot of levels, but I'm not the way that was. And so over, you know, 40 years, I can say that's kind of extraordinary. And so I was saying earlier about my life being an inspiration, or our life becoming an inspiration. I say to myself, who knows what's possible? Right. Who knows what's... And then, you know, you hear the story of Angulimala, you know, like, which we believe isn't just a teaching story. You know, he's a serial killer, right? And he gives it all up and he becomes awakened. You know, well, like, how's that possible? You know, and so I think that we, almost across the board, do ourselves an enormous disservice of underestimating who we are and what may be possible in our lives. I know we do that just in daily life. You know, we define ourselves in such a small way. And I really believe it in spiritual life. And I have so many people that I've worked with where the changes I've seen in them, I think, are startling. For me, they're almost unbelievable that somebody could make that kind of progress in a lifetime, you know, much less in 10 or 15 years. That I just don't know what's possible. And so it's a real open question for me, and I find it very exciting. And that's enough for me.
All right.
You know, so... And I'm sure that somebody here tonight, either because of the talk or the meditation, woke up, and you're probably embarrassed to admit it. Make everybody else feel bad. So. Yes?
No, I mean, your whole presentation, that is kind of begs the issue, which I think I know your answer, right? I don't know.
You know my answer?
Yeah, well, I don't know. quite sure what the sutras would say and what you would say. Okay. So can the householder reach enlightenment?
That's just what we were talking about.
I know, but yeah. I didn't quite see the clarity of it.
Well, it's because I don't know. I believe that I absolutely believe that that's true. I know that the Buddha said that that's true.
Okay.
And I think it's like everything else in life. It's like, well, can you become president? Well, maybe you can't at your age, or I can't at my age, you know. But, you know, so much of this is dependent. Classically, in Buddhist thought, people said that there are like four fundamental personality types. And then that there are, in addition to these personality types, there's people who learn quickly and don't learn quickly, and people who have ease of practice and they find practice very difficult. And whether or not, you know, I mean, those are just all schematics, but I mean, I know from working with lots of people that for some people, this practice is so hard. And it's always inspirational to see people that it's so hard for them that they persist. And that for other people, boy, they pick things up and they really make some progress. I mean, really quickly, you know. So I think that there's a whole set of capacities that and tendencies of mind that people either have or they don't have. And to answer the question of, well, is it possible? Yes, I personally, at this point in my life, in the stage, yes, I absolutely believe that. I do believe it's possible for a householder. I refer to, you know, a community level practitioner, depending on how they're practicing and if they're supplementing it with retreat work. I believe it. Yeah, I absolutely believe it. How realistic that is for most people is another question, because I was saying, you know, like a balanced life is, my belief is that most people who are community practitioners, they're not living a balanced life. It's totally out of balance in terms of their effort and attention. That most of their effort and attention is directed towards all this other stuff. It's not directed towards your spiritual life, and it's not directed towards figuring out how to integrate their spiritual life into all of their daily life, so that it's all out of balance. If it starts to get into balance, you know, I think that we just don't know what's possible. Because if every moment of your day, or close to every moment of your day, is like being aware and awake and spiritual, you know, like you're trying to figure out this out, who knows? So.
I've been investigating, I guess, balance in a slightly different sense. I think it fits here, though, and it has to do with being mindful in daily life. And it has to do with paying attention to the things that are habitual in my, like in my work life and things like that, that really don't feel good. And the balance piece for me at this point is to try not to have a preference of what I look at and what I won't look at. So, like, really trying, the piece about paying attention for me lately has really been to try and not get charged up when I notice, like, oh, I'm doing it again, or ouch, this hurts, or oh, I'm late, or, you know, late for another appointment, or whatever the habitual thing where is I run the number about myself. When you were talking about the, you know, not harming yourself and or others, and realizing just how the mind state is what sets that whole thing up, and how, in fact, I was talking with the person I rode with tonight about how different it is at retreat to do the things that you really want to do with your life, and then when you come home, gosh, oh gee, somehow that doesn't happen anymore. And realizing that it really is one of those, it is a decision to make about not going there. And so this is wonderful in terms of balancing householder life and spiritual life, and really seeing that, for me, it's the fulcrum is really, how do I pay attention to both sides, good things and bad things, and not have a preference long enough to actually see what they really are?
Yeah.
Does that
make sense? Well, absolutely. I think that's good practice, and it's actually not having a preference, it's not becoming attached.
Not becoming attached.
To the preference.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
So, yeah, and I mean, that's it. I mean, like, that kind of inquiry. Like, what does it take, you know, in all these different aspects of our life? There is a LinkedIn, you know, the online service, you know, they send out these little things every so often. And it's like, I don't know, like five articles or stories. So the one that they just sent out was an essay written by Deepak Chopra on routine at work. And he doesn't use any of the language that we're using, but it's the same thing. And he's just talking about how routine at work and not seeing the routine deadens your mind, makes you unaware, all of these different things. And, you know, then he has a number of catchy little suggestions. But, you know, just the fact that he wrote that and LinkedIn was willing to send it out was really encouraging to me. You know, is really a nice little piece. So, okay, yes. One.
You referred to seeing things in your practice that you'd rather not see,
mm-hmm.
or that are uncomfortable to see. And in the context of being blameless in relationships with other people, what is a skillful way to handle when you feel that you see ways that other people in your life are harming themselves or you, or harming each other, and the message, and it seems to be require a great deal of sensitivity, because it's not a message that wants to be heard. So any thoughts on how to handle that?
Well, that's a tricky one. Yeah. Well, so we're talking about you're seeing something in someone else. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think the first thing is making an assessment of the capacity of the other person actually to hear what you want to say, and trying to be really honest about that, and. You know, depending on the kind of relationship you have with that person and the skill set they have, you know, you may be able to thoughtfully, kindly, you know, raise something and have a good discussion about it, and maybe you can't, you know. Like, I have a very good friend right now. They have an issue going on with their child, and they're a blended family, you know, where they each have kids from. And so the situation came up, and the one parent brought the issue to the other parent, man, it's just disastrous, you know. And I think it's a combination of the way that it was brought to the other person, and that to raise such a sensitive topic with that person required a lot of reflection of, like, how to do it, when was the appropriate time, all, you know. So so that's the first thing. I mean, I think this thing about right speech and kindness and not harming is quite profound in terms of relationships. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that I think we have to be absolutely committed to being truthful. And I think it's really common that, you know, you get in there, and I don't mean truth telling in the sense of, you know, this is my truth, but like something's happening and that you're unequivocally truthful about your perception and your experience of it. Once again, in a completely kind and thoughtful way. And so that you're not pulling back, you're not coding it in some way to make it more digestible. Because I think any, whether it's a business relationship, a professional relationship, a family relationship, in the end, if it doesn't come down to that, it eventually has the wrong karmic results. It creates confusion about what people are really feeling and how they're relating to each other. So those are my best thoughts at the moment. Yeah. Okay. So one more.
I wrestled a lot with living above a basic need level. And so I understand applying the precepts to the accumulation of wealth, and that's, logical. But what's difficult for me is that most Americans, or other countries too, many people live above what, and I do myself, live above what we basically need. So I'm having a little trouble, and I go through periods that I just feel the right thing would be to get rid of my material possessions in some responsible way, and live sort of bare bones, which probably wouldn't even compare to survival level of many people. Still. And so I have something I wrestle with, and maybe it's, I can only guess it's probably from my dad who lived through the Depression, or what, I don't know what it is, but it's, something I wrestle with.
If you picked it up from your dad who went through the Depression, you'd probably be hoarding. Right? And so many folks who went through the Depression, end up being hoarders. Yeah.
Well, so. A lighter thing than hoarder, but similar, is just being sort of desperate to ensure this level of life, or acquiring the next biggest house, or the I wrestle with that, and I wonder if you
Well, I think there's kind of a series of issues. The first one is, I don't think there's anything, at least in this discussion tonight, the issue isn't how much you've got, it's how you acquire it. That's the first issue. Mm-hmm. So if you acquire it ethically and without harming other people, that the acquisition itself, there's nothing wrong with it. The second element there is, once you acquire, what do you do with it? And both of those kind of go to, well, what is your real intention? Am I just acquiring stuff to be wealthy? Am I acquiring it just to feed some kind of desire or attachment that I have, which would not be considered healthy from this perspective? But I think that, once again, this all has to be balanced. And we have to be reflective about, well, what is our intention? So, like, if I want to have fewer things, well, why is that? Is it because I've gotten an idea in my mind that I'm a good person if I do that? So I'm striving to be a good person, so I'm going to get rid of all these things? Well, it's just another desire that you're feeding. If the purpose is that at some point in our life, there a switch goes off because of practice, and renunciation has become a value, so that I'm looking at things and realizing that I'm attached to things, and that attachment is not good, that it's fostering and supporting other mind states that are not healthy. So starting to willow that all down as a practice makes a lot of sense. That's a different thing. Mm-hmm. And so and you can take this as a variation on a theme and work with this in a bunch of different ways, but you can just hear from that, see, I don't think that there's a value in and of itself here of well, I'm just going to get rid of things, and so I'm a better Buddhist, or I'm a better practitioner, or I'm a better something. That's not it. It's like, what is the motivation? Is it a healthy motivation from a Buddhist perspective? Healthy motivation is one that's pointing our mind towards some sort of clear seeing, making wise choices, balance, as opposed to just being reactive. You know, I need to get rid of things. I need to get smaller. I want to be, I think this is going to make me a better Buddhist. So now I think for each one of us, right? This is what I was saying. Like, I won't mention your name. but, you know, you were talking about how you were kind of trying to work through that work thing. Well, other people might come into that a little different way. But it's the process that is the key thing, in the same way that it's not whether you have wealth or have more than you think you need. It's how you acquire it and then what you do with it. And I guess it's the age that I'm at, but I think it's perfectly okay, and I think that these suttas are very clear that having some kind of sound financial safety net so that you feel secure in the world is not only a wise thing, that it's consistent with what the Buddha is saying. If I'm constantly thinking that I'm going to be in trouble next year or the year after financially, if that is constant, I'm constantly thinking about that, I don't feel safe in the world. And that's going to impinge on my ability to practice well. And I mean, it's nice to say, oh, we'll just make that a practice. Okay? And that's true. You know, I mean, if that's the situation you're in. But what this is talking about is actually safeguarding your resources so you're not creating that kind of suffering. That's very clearly a terrible form of suffering, and you may know actually many people who are feeling this way right now, and you can see that it disrupts their lives, and it's a terrible form of suffering. So through setting up some artificial value about who we think we need to be or want to be, and it results in that, that's not good practice. Okay. So thank you very much for coming tonight. In a world where there is so much suffering and we get to know about it immediately now, may all of our efforts here tonight and all of our efforts during the week in some real way contribute to the reduction of our own suffering and the reduction of the suffering of people that we love, and also in some very real way lead to some true measure of peace and happiness in the world. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm.